Okay, we're beginning here by the two dots on the top of Ayin Chet Amud Aleph. The Gemara quotes from the Mishnah, Mayim, Kedei Lashof Behem Et HaKilor. The amount of water that you have to carry in order to be Chayav is the amount of water that you would add to Kolorim, which is an eye salve that's used to wash out or cleanse the eye. So the water you would add to that salve, that's the amount of water that's significant enough that we would classify it as carrying if you took that water out. So Amar Abaye, Abaye lays down principles with regards to this. That is Michtei. Komilta de Shchicha Velo Shchicha. If you have an item that is used for a popular or common practice, below shchicha, and something that is not so common or popular, azul rabbanan batar de shchicha lekula, the rabbanan would follow the more common usage of the item, even that turns out to be a lekula, and the Gemara will bring examples of that in a second. Shchicha u'shchicha, if you have two usages or utilizations of a particular item, and both of them are common or popular, azul rabbanan batar de shchicha lechumra. Then in that instance, the Chachamim would pick whichever one turns out to be the Chumrah. Once again, the Gemara will bring examples of that. Yayin, when it comes to drinking wine, Shtiato Shchicha. Drinking wine is a common practice. It's something that's very popular. Whereas Rufuato, using it as a medicinal part of the salve, is Lo Shchicha, is not so common. As Rashi notes over here, that the eye salve needs a liquid in it to help make it into a salve that can be placed or used to cleanse the eye. And so different liquids were optional here. Could be wine, could be milk, or it could be water. And so what the Gemara is saying is that sometimes people use wine, but that is a less common usage than water because water is cheaper and people are more likely to drink the wine than they are to use it inside of the salve. So for that reason, you have two options with regards to wine as to what's considered to be the shear of wine. One of them relates to the drinking of the wine, which is a common practice. The other one related to the medicinal usage of the wine, which is not such a common practice. And therefore the Chachamim here followed that one that is shchicha, even though it turns out to be the kula. Because drinking of wine is a larger shiur than the amount you would need to liquefy the eye salve. And so despite that fact, they went after that which was azul rabbanan batar shtiato l'shchicha l'kula. Rabbanan went after the more common usage, even though it turns out to be a kula here. Chalav, when it comes to milk. Achilato shchicha. Drinking milk, or quote-unquote eating milk, is a more common usage of the milk. Rufuato, using it to be added to the eye salve or medicinal usage, is lo shchicha, is not so common. And therefore, azul rabbanan batar achilato, the kula, they follow the more common practice, which is the eating or drinking of milk. And therefore, they had the larger shiur for milk, which are the shiurim that we saw in our Mishnah with regards to wine and with regards to milk. Both of those have to do with the drinking of the wine and the drinking of the milk, not the medicinal usage, which is a smaller shiur. On the other hand, dvash, when it comes to honey, achilato shchicha, people eat honey, they use honey in food substances, and refuato shchicha, it's also commonly used for ailments we saw before in the Gemara, that was used for the sores on the back of the animals, and that was the only item that could be used there. That's also a very common usage of the honey. Therefore, azul rabbanan batar refuato l'chumra. Therefore, they set the standard in the Mishnah as being that which is the medicinal usage, even though that's a more l'chumra shi'ur, and there's just as equal usage or utilization that is for drinking it, which would be a larger shi'ur. Nevertheless, since they're both as commonly used, they went to the chumra on that side and said that the lower shi'ur will qualify in terms of the hotza'ah. Elamayim, what I don't understand, Abaye says, so now I set out these principles, they all seem to work in the Mishnah, except with regards to water. Michtei shtiato shchicha. Drinking water is a very common practice. As Rashi notes over here, that people drink wine during their meals, but in general, when you're thirsty, you drink water. Rufuato lo shchicha. And using it for medicinal purposes is not as common. It's more common to use it as a drink than it is to use it for medicinal purposes. And the way that Rashi describes it over here is because in the medicinal usage, you can substitute the water with milk or wine. I mean, there are other options to use. So then, maitai mazul rabbanan batar refuato l'chumra. And why does the Mishnah give the qualification for the shiur of water as being dependent or connected to its medicinal usage, which is what we started off the Gemara with today? Mayim kedei l'shof behem et hakilor, meaning that if that's the less common usage, then I would not follow the more common usage of the drinking of the water. So Amar Abaye says, I'll tell you what the solution to that seeming contradiction to the principle I laid out is, Begalila shanu. We're speaking about in the Galil. Rashi here, the Shitato, says that the people in the north, the people in the Galil, were poor. And therefore, they were very makpid on wine and milk because they didn't have so much of it. So they wouldn't use that for medicinal purposes. They would use that for drinking purposes because those were luxury items. And therefore, they wouldn't put it into a salve. Water, on the other hand, which is cheaper, more commonly found, they would use that for medicinal purposes. So for them, the only liquid that they used in the medicinal salve or the eye salve was water. And therefore, for the people in the Galil, it was just as common to be used as a medicinal solution as it is to be used for drinking. And we said before, if two things are just as common, then we go to Chumrah. So that's Rashi's explanation here. And that accords with Rashi's explanation back on Mem Zayin Amud Aleph. But we also had a similar situation where the Gemara answered that we were speaking about the people of the Galil. And Rashi over there said that they were poor. And therefore, they used pieces of tilot, were chashuv, were significant to them, and that's why they were not batel. So Rashi is consistent in that approach. Tosafot back on Mem Zayin Amud Aleph says that he thinks that Rashi is incorrect, that the people of the Galil actually were very wealthy, and therefore he disagrees in both situations with Rashi. He says, first of all, in the case in Mem Zayin Amud Aleph, says the reason that the tilot were significant is because they had so much oil in the north that oil or shemen wasn't so significant to them, and that's why it wasn't mevatel the wicks or the pieces of the wicks that were there. In addition, in our situation, he says what Rashi is saying doesn't make so much sense. If they were so poor that they didn't have so much wine or they didn't have so much milk, then the most common drink that they had was probably water. And then that once again would create a disparity between the drinking, which would be much more common because they didn't have milk or wine. They'd be drinking a lot more water. And then that would be a higher utilization, a more normal or probable usage of the water than for the salve or for medicinal purposes. So he says even if you believe that they were poor and they didn't have that, it wouldn't solve your problem. And therefore, he explains over there, rather that they were very wealthy and they had tons of wine. In the north, similar to what the Rabbeinu Tam said with regards to the oil, that they had a ton of oil, therefore it wasn't so important or wasn't so significant to them. Similarly, with regards to wine, they had so much of it that it wasn't so significant, and therefore they drank wine not only during their meals, but even when they were thirsty, they drank wine because it was so common. And therefore, the water usage was more common to be used in the medicinal purposes because all of their drinking happened with wine. That's the way the Balei HaTosfot would explain it. Over there on Mem Zayin Amud Aleph, there's a quote in Masoret HaShas from the Tosfot Yishanim. And over there, the Tosfot Yishanim says that because they drank so much wine in the north, then they had the problem of Chakalili Einayim, that their eyes were bloodshot or were problematic because of the commonness of drinking wine. And therefore, they had to do more eye salves than normal, because they were so affected by the wine. And that caused them then to use more water towards rifu'ah because they needed it more commonly because of the amount of wine that they drank. So that's a little bit of a derivative of what we saw from the Balei HaTosafot. The Rabbeinu Chananel on our daf says over here that it's because in the Galil, the waters of the Galil were unique. And that is that me Galil that are yidu'im shmo'im la'ayin bikilor shehein They were known, the waters in the north or in the Galil were especially effective in terms of being an eye salve or in terms of cleaning out the eye. And therefore, mayim in general is a revi'it because regular waters or water anywhere else is a drinking substance. It's not used in the eye salve. On the other hand, when it comes to the waters of the Galil, where they are especially effective in terms of being medicinal and helping out the eye, there the waters were judged by the medicinal size, which is much smaller than the revi'it, which is the size of the threshold for drinking. And that's the way the Rabbeinu Chananel explains our Gemara over here. Rava Amar, on the other hand, Rava says the answer is, afilu tema b'shar mikamot. Doesn't have to be in the Galil alone. It could be in other places. According to Rashi, that means because in other places where they are wealthier. According to the Balei HaTosafot, it's in other places where they're not so flush with wine. Or according to the Rabbeinu Chananel, in other places where the water is not considered to be so efficacious or medicinally helpful. Kedish Shmuel. But the reason is like Shmuel. Damar Shmuel kol shakyane. When it comes to any liquid, Masu umetalli. They are good for the eye salve in that they are medicinally effective, but they also dim the eye or cause the eyesight to be impeded because, as Rashi says over here, they harden in the eye and they create like a glue that sticks the eye together, and therefore it hurts the person's ability to see. The var, with the exception of mimayo, if you use water in the eye salve, to masu velo metalele, that it's curative, and it doesn't cause this side effect of dimming the eye or causing the eye to seal shut. And therefore people favor using water over other liquids because it's the most effective in terms of the least side effects with the benefits of its curative properties. And that's why mayim is considered to be refuah and not drinking, because refuah is shchiah with water. Even though you can use other liquids, water is the most effective liquid with the least side effects. And that's why its most common usage then is for refuah. That's the way that Rashi explains it. The Rabbeinu Hananel here seemingly had a different girsa in the Gemara, and he says the following, that kulo shakyane, all liquids, malu visade, they are beneficial in terms of their medicinal quality, visade, and they also are satisfying, bar min mayo, with the exception of water, demale begarde, that it is effective in terms of its curative properties, but it's not satisfying. Sheina mayim suadim kimine ma'achal. Water is not satiating like other foods. Ela ikar shtiatan kein refua. But the main reason for drinking it is because it's like it's medicinal, meaning that it quenches thirst, but does not bring satiation to the individual. And therefore, even when you drink it as a drink for thirst, it's really acting or functioning in a medicinal manner, because it's simply curing the problem of thirst, but not providing satiation, as opposed to other drinks, which also provide satiation like food, and therefore they're considered more significant for their drinking than they are for their medicinal side. And that's the way that the Rabbeinu Hananel explains Rava's answer over here, that water is always medicinal. Even when you drink it for thirst, it's really functioning like a medicine. Now the Gemara continues, recording from the Mishnah, and says, V'shar kol ha-mashkim b'revi'it. All of their liquids, their threshold for carrying on Shabbat is a revi'it. Tan Rabbanan. We have a bright on the Tosefta, dam v'chol minei mashkim b'revi'it. When it comes to blood or any other liquid, the measurement of the threshold for carrying to be chayav is a revi'it. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar omer, dam kedei l'chol b'ayin achat. That Rabbi Shimon Elazar says that when it comes to blood, that is measured by the amount it would take to paint one of your eyes. Shekein kochlim livrakit. Because they use blood when it comes to someone who has a problem in their eye. Livrakit, Rashi describes over here as some sort of growth or wart that's on the eye. Umay nihu, what type of blood is efficacious for solving that problem? Dama de tarnagolet bara, it is the blood of the wild chicken. So this wild fowl or wild chicken, that blood was utilized in order to be medicinally effective for this livrakit. And therefore, that dam does not have the threshold of revi'it, which is the normal threshold for liquids, but rather the amount that it would take to paint one eye, which would be less than a revi'it, because that's its primary purpose, is for this medicinal usage. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer, dam kedei l'chol bo ayin achat. The blood is the amount to paint one eye, so similar to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, but for a different reason. Shekein kochlim liyarud, because you use it to paint the eye for... Rashi describes over here white spots on the eye. It seems to be that he's describing something along the lines of a cataract. My nihu. And what is useful or efficacious in solving that problem? Dama de krushtina. The blood of a bat. The simanech. And the way to remember Rabbi Shimon Elazar versus Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's position is gava legava. The bird that lives in the inhabited or civilized areas, which is the bat. That's legava, that's for the internal eye, which is the problem with the cataract. Bara, use the wild chicken, or the one that's outside of the inhabited or settled areas, because it's out in the wild. That's legbara, the one that's external to the eye, or projecting out of the eye, which is the wart or the growth on the eye. So that's how you remember which dam is useful for which ailment. Vame dvarim amurim. So now we have a cryptic statement in the Braita, which the Gemara will then take up and explain. And Rashi and Tosafot differ over here as to how to properly explain this. B'med d'varim mamurim, when is that true? B'motzi, when you took it out. Aval b'matznia, if you store it, koshu chayav, then any amount would make you chayav. Rabbi Shimon omer, b'med d'varim mamurim, when is that true? B'matznia, when you store it. Aval b'motzi, enu chayav el b'rivit. But if you simply take it out, then a revi'it is the threshold. Umodim chachamim the Rabbi Shimon, and the chachamim agreed to Rabbi Shimon b'motzi shofchim the reshut rabim. When you take out wastewater to the reshut rabim, shishiuran be revi'it. That threshold is a revi'it. She had three sections to the latter part of the Baraita, and now the Gemara is going to go back and explain each one of them to make sense out of it. Amamar, b'med dvarim amurim. When is that true? B'motzi. That's only when you carried it out. Abo b'matznia. If you store it, koshu, then it would be enough if it was any amount. Gemara asks, atu matznia, lav motzihu. Just because you store something doesn't mean you're chayav on Shabbat. The only reason you're chayav on Shabbat for storing something is because you were motziit. So isn't the reason that you're chayav for matznia because you took it out? So what's the difference between motzi and matznia? Amar Abaye. Abaye comes to clarify this for us. Hachav amayaskina. What is this situation over here? B'talmid shamar lo rabo. It is a student. A student here doesn't mean literally a student, but rather an apprentice. The way Rashi describes it over here, it's a carpenter's apprentice that's working with his master. He's apprenticed himself to the master carpenter. The master says to the apprentice, Lechu pneli makom l'seuda. Go clear out a space for me so that we can eat. Halach uvane lo davar chashuv lakol. If he went and cleared away something that was important or significant to everyone, meaning that generally or by default, everybody would consider this to be something of significance, then chayav ilave. Then he is chayav for carrying that item. If he accidentally then carried that item when he was doing the bidding of his master, he would be chayav a chatat. Davar sheinu chashuv lakol. On the other hand, if it's something that's not so important to others, I mean, it's not considered in general significant, yatsne rabe, but his master did store something of that size, michaye vilave, he would be chayav for carrying that out by accident, vilo, lo michayev if he didn't, or meaning if his master didn't store something of that size, then lo michayev, he wouldn't be chayav for carrying. The way Rashi explains this is that this is an extension of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar's position. And Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar believes that when a person stores something, as we saw earlier in the Gemara, then that gives it significance. Not only does it give it significance for the individual who stored it, it also gives significance to anybody who carries it out. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar was of the opinion of the view, and that's why we said he couldn't have been the author of the Mishnah in the previous parak, is because he believes that once somebody stores something, not only does that impact on that individual's carrying of the item, but it also affects anybody else who carries that item. Since it's been granted significance by its owner, anyone, not just the owner who carries it out, will be chayav. And that's what Rashi claims is happening over here, according to Abaye. That here, there's a standard shiur, then the Talmid is chayav because everybody carries that out. Everybody considers that significant, and therefore if you carry it, you're chayav. If it's something that his master stored, then that master gave that item significance. And if the Talmid carries it out, now he's going to be chayav because of the master's granting significance to that item. Or that, in essence, is Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar's opinion that another individual can create significance and be influential even for other parties or third parties who come and carry it. And the truth is that Abaye didn't have to go that way. Abaye could have just simply said it was talking about the master himself. And the master himself carried it out. But if he did that, you'd only learn one chiddush over here. The fact that he spoke about the apprentice, and even though it wasn't the apprentice who stored it, but the master, it shows you the additional din, or this additional item here that the machshav of one individual can impact on the other individual. And that's how Rashi explains this Gemara over here. The Baal Yom Tov just asked one question on Rashi, which is, how does he know this is following the opinion of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar? It's nice that Rashi says that that's what's happening here, but if you look in the order of the Tosefta and the Braita that we quoted, Rabbi Shimon Elazar's opinion was brought, and then Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's opinion was brought. And only afterwards is this statement of Bamed Varim Amurim brought in the Mishnah. And therefore the Baal Yom Tov would say it's more likely that the Bamed Varim Amurim is associated with Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's position than it is that it's associated with Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar's opinion. And the nature of the Gemara's question then is, there's a matznia. Someone stores something, then why is anyone else chayav for it except for the person who stored it? Because there's only one Tana who believes that the machshava of one individual can be influential on the other, and that's Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. So then when the Braita says, b'med v'im amurim b'motzi, but by matznia you are chayav, The Gemara is assuming then that the machshava of one individual giving it or imbuing it with significance then will be influential for others. But that's a dat yachid of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. And since we left off with Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, it sounds like this is the opinion of Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel or the opinion of all the other Tanaim, and therefore that wouldn't fit. The answer Abaye gives is that this is a unique case. It's a unique case because it's an apprentice with his master. That's what it says. According to Rashi, what was the significance of speaking about an apprentice versus a master? It could be true of any two individuals, according to Rashi, because that's Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar's opinion. One person's machshova influences anybody else, any third party. So what the Gemara is answering, according to Tosafot, or what Abaye is saying is, because this is an apprentice-master relationship, then the apprentice acts always as an extension of the master, as a proxy of the master. And therefore, if the master grants its significance, the Talmid, the apprentice, is affected by that. Nobody else would be affected by it. So it is the opinion of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel that if you are machshiv something, then it gives it chashivut. It has no impact on anyone else, except in this particular relationship where you have a master-apprentice relationship, because the apprentice always acts based on the desires or the considerations of the master. And since he's a proxy for the master, he carries something that the master considered significant or stored and made it significant, he will be chayav for it. And that's the answer that Abaye is giving over here as to why this is true, even though nowhere else do we believe that the machshava of one individual can impact on the other as individuals. So then we have the interim section of the Braita that said, Rabbi Shimon Omer, b'me dvarim umim b'matznia, that all these shiurim in the Mishnah are a case where you gave it significance. That's when you are chayav for carrying it. Aval b'motzi, if you actually carry it out without having any matzniya, then revit is the standard for all liquids according to Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Shimon says the default standard of all liquids is a revit. All the measurements that are given by the Chachamim in the Mishnah, only in a case where someone stored it for that particular reason, as opposed to the Chachamim who believe just the opposite, which is that these are the default shiurim for these particular liquids, unless someone does something to undermine that. These are the default shiurim for all of these items, no matter who takes it out. So, but the Braita then ended off with, which is Modim Chachamim to Rabbi Shimon. Chachamim agreed to Rabbi Shimon that by Motzi Shofchim, when you take out wastewater, that the standard for that is Revi'it, and everybody agrees that that is the standard. And on that, the Gemara asks, Shofchim Lamai Chazu. This wastewater, what is it useful for? From Rashi, it makes it sound like the Gemara's question is a generic question. In the Mishnah, in the Braita, where we mention Shofchim, what is the purpose of those Shofchim? Tosafot over here says that they're not true, that the Shofchim we're speaking about here is in the Braita. The reason the Gemara did not ask about the wastewater in the Mishnah is because the wastewater in the Mishnah, we know what you can use it for. It's water that's not potable, but it's still water that has usage because it's not so dirty. Therefore, you could use it to wash dishes with it, you could use it for other things that don't need to be potable water, but it's not so disgusting that you wouldn't do anything that's normal usage of water with. But in the Braita, where the first part of the Braita spoke about Dam, and then the latter part spoke about Shofchim, Tosafot says it sounds like that Shofchim is similar to Dam, which is something that's ma'us, something that's disgusting. So it's really not just not potable water, it's disgusting water. And yet the Braita says that the shiur for that type of water is Revi. And the Gemara's question about that in the Braita is, Shofchim Lamai Chazu, what are they useful for? So Amar Rabbi Yirmiya, legabel behem etatit. You can use it for mixing the cement. It's helpful for making the plaster or the cement. You can use that type of water because you wouldn't use it for any of the normal things you use water for. But it could be used for mixing of cement, which is dirty and disgusting anyway. Batanyo. But don't we have a brighter tit? The amount of tit that you need is kdei lasot behem pi kur, which is the upcoming Mishnah, where we'll see the amount of cement or plaster that you need is to make a passageway into the cauldron of the smelter. So that's a smaller amount of teat than the amount that you would mix with a revit of water. Mar says, Lokasha, that's not a problem. Had the migbo, had the lo migbo. Depends on whether he's mixed it already or he hasn't mixed it. Fish ain't adam toreach, the gabel teat, that's a pikur. Because a person will not go and make cement or plaster just for the purpose of creating this hole or entrance into the cauldron of the smelter, which we'll see again in the upcoming Mishnah, because that's just too much work for too little utility. So if a person is already going to go make cement or plaster, they're going to make a larger quantity of it, and that larger quantity would require a revit worth of water. And that's what we're speaking about in the Braita, and that's what's useful for the Mishulchim. So that's a large amount of teat. Once you already have the teat made, then how much is considered to be significant? That's the amount to make this opening for the cauldron, and that's a smaller amount. So there's a difference between if you were before the fact, there you would only do it if you have sufficient reason to make a large amount of teat, because it's a lot of work, and you'd only do that if you had usage for it for a larger number of items. Once it's already made, then it's significant when you do something that would be meaningful with it, and that is like making a pi hakur. And that's the difference between the tit that's already made versus the shofchim, which is for tit that has yet to be made, and that's why it's a larger quantity or larger size that we're speaking about. Now the next Mishnah speaks about different items. Someone who takes out a rope, what is considered to be the significant amount of rope, they lasso those in the kupa, to make a handle for a basket. Gemi, a reed, is kedei lasot tlai lenafa ulekavara. It's to make a hanging strip for a sieve or a sifter. Rabbi Yehuda omer, kedei litol mimenu midat mnal lekatan. It's used for measuring the size of the foot of a young child in order to take it to the shoemaker to have him make the right size shoe. It's a foot measurer. And that's what you use a gemi for. Niyar, paper, although Rashi calls it over here papyrus, it's made out of asif, it's made out of vegetation. It's to write on it a tax receipt that you had paid the toll for the bridge toll wherever you were going. We're going to see in the Gemara that is two large letters that are written on this item in order to present as a receipt for the taxes paid or for an exemption from the taxes. Vahamutsi kesher mochsim chayav. But someone who takes out a tax receipt is chayav. Now that seems to be duplicative because we just said that the amount of papyrus or paper that you take out is for a tax receipt, and now we're saying that a tax receipt is chayav. So Tosafot explains is that if you write a tax receipt on cloth, on parchment, then it still would be chayav, even though that's not the normal way to write it because that's expensive. And for the tax receipt, you normally wouldn't write on it. But despite the fact, if you do write on it, you're still chayav for taking out that size, even though we're going to see in a second for cloth, there's a higher threshold of size which you need because it's a more expensive item. A more expensive item, you'd only utilize it for something that is significant, therefore the size is bigger. Nevertheless, if you did use it for a tax receipt, you are chayav. Ramban, on the other hand, suggests that maybe when we said kedei lechtov alav kesher mochsin was just giving you a identification of size, but not telling you that a tax receipt is really chayav. And therefore the Mishnah says right afterwards, not only is that a measure of size with regards to niyar, also it in and of itself is a significant item, and therefore a tax receipt would also be chayav. Niyar machuk, so the Mishnah continues, if you have something that was utilized already and then erased, then it's not useful for writing on it anymore because you can't write on something once it's erased, but it is useful, kedei lechrol chaltzlochit ktana shel plaiton. It is good to use for a small file of perfume, which are kept in very small bottles, and you use this as the plug for the top of the bottle, and therefore, it's useful for that, and that would be the significant amount that you would have to carry in order to be chayav because of that utility. Or, when it comes to leather, kedei lasot kmiya, it would be enough leather or enough ore that you could write an amulet on it, or some say that you could wrap up an amulet in it. Klaf, as Rashi says here, is more expensive, and therefore you can only use it for things that are very significant or need klaf. Then it's kedei lechtov alav parsha ktanash b'tfilin, shushma Yisrael. To write the smallest parsha in the tfilin, there are four parshiot in the tfilin, b'shma v'yayim shema, kadesh, and v'yaki v'yecha, and the smallest of them is shma, and therefore it's a reference to the parsha of shma in the tfilin. Dio, when it comes to ink, kedei lechtov bet otiot. It's the amount that it would take to write two letters. That's the amount of ink that is considered to be significant, like we saw before with regards to writing, that the Mishkan had what was considered to be significant was the writing of two letters, because you can use that to pair up different items, parts of the kli, krashim, all different things, by writing the same letter or number on two different items. Kol, which is stibium, again, some sort of eye salve. They had the kol ayin achat, the amount that it would take or be sufficient to color one eye. Devek, glue, kedei liten barosh ashafshaf. it's a bed on top of a, seems to be a long, like, broomstick with a platform on the top that they put glue, and they use it to capture birds or as a animal trap. Zefet v'gafrit, pitch and tar, v'lasot nekev, in order to make a hole. So this was used, as Rashi explains over here, when you're speaking about raw silver or mercury, it was stored in a small container, and that container was then sealed with pitch and tar, so that it would not escape, and then they would puncture a small hole in the pitch or tar that would allow you to then use it as a dropper to pour out that raw silver or mercury, because the meaning of mercury is a liquid silver, and that might be what Rashi's referring to over here, that this is a dispenser for mercury. Sha'ava, when it comes to wax, kedei litein al pi nekev katan, the amount of wax it would take to plug up a small hole. Harasit, as Rashi says, is crushed bricks, which is some sort of clay material. De la sod pikur shel tzorfei zahav. The amount to make the opening to the cauldron of the gold smelters, which they had to get the fire to a very, very high temperature. And in order to do that, they used to have bellows that used to blow air into the cauldron. And so they had to make small holes or openings in the cauldron to allow the bellows to be there to reach those high temperatures for the smelting of the gold. So that charasit is to make that type of opening on the smelting cauldron. Rav Yehuda Omer, kedei lasot pitput. It's to make a tripod or a stand that they put the pots on when they are cooking them. Subim bran, kedei natein apikur shel tzurfei zahav. Rashi says it was used as an alternative if you didn't have coals in order to fire up the smelting cauldrons. Sid, the amount of lime, is kedei lasud ktana shebebanot, is in order to put on even the smallest of youngsters as a depilatory. It was used as a depilatory for young girls who were showing hair before they were already mature. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, kedei lasot kilkul, to make it some sort of primitive mousse that holds down the side curls of the girl's hair. Rabbi Nechemia Omer, kedei lasot undepi. And Rabbi Nechemia says it's to take off the hair, the thin hair that's below the temple of the woman, that thin hair was taken off with this seed. So now the Gemara is going to go through the items of the Mishnah. Chevel, when it comes to a rope, chevel nami lechayev, why by rope you're not chayav, kedei lasot lai lenapa ulekvara? Why isn't it used as an item to hang up the sifter or the sieve with? Because we saw that you use a gemi for that. But if you use the rope for that, it would be a shorter amount than making it into a handle for a basket. So why don't you say a rope is sufficient if it is enough to hang up these utensils? Kim de charik b'mana lo abde inche. Since it's a rope is abrasive in nature, and the sifter and the sieve are usually made out of wood, if you put this rope into it to hang it up, it would rub against the kli and wear it down. And therefore they used gemi, they used reeds for this and not rope for that, and that's why rope was only associated with the basket or the handle of a basket. Tarabanan, chutzin, kedei lasot ozen, lesal, fifa mitzrit. When it comes to the leaves of the palm tree, it's to make a handle for a Egyptian basket which was made out of these palm leaves. So these seem to be the harder leaves or shoots of the palm tree. The size that would be significant for carrying would be the amount to make a handle for a basket that was woven out of the palm leaves that were moister or softer. Sieve, which is the stringy, fibrous bark of the palm tree. Acherim omrim, which the Gemara in Hor Yod says is associated with the sheet of Rabbi Meir. Ketein litein al pi mashpich katan. The amount that you would put on the opening into a small pitcher or funnel in order to filter the wine. So that fibrous material, if you had enough to create that filter, that would be sufficient to be chayav for carrying it. Ravav, Rashi claims over here, ravav can either be fat or oil. Tosafot disagrees and says oil has its own shiur, which we already saw in the Mishnah, and therefore ravav is only referring to fats. De la such tachat ispagin ktana. It is amount of fat or oil, according to Rashi, that you would put under a small, like, fried crepe that you would be frying in the oven. Bekama shiura. What's the size of this small pancake or crepe that you're making? Shiura kesela. That's the size of a coin, a sela. Ba'atanya kugugeret. Don't we have a braita that says it's the size of a dried fig? Idividi chad shiurahu. A sela and a dried fig are roughly the same size, and therefore that's the standard. Tosfot over here says that if you do this, you have to be careful because you're making the oven fleshik by putting in the fat there, and therefore it has to be something that has a siman in it, that the bread or the item that you're cooking is fleishik now because of the fats that were put in there. And the fat that's put into the oven has to be a small enough amount that the flavor will dissipate before people forget that the oven is actually fleishik now. Anything that you bake in there is going to be fleishik until the fats disappear. And mukin, soft items, that can be cotton, it could be worn down rags, anything that's soft, kedei lasot kadur ktana, in order to make stuffing for a small ball, bekama shiuro, what's the size of a small ball, okay, it goes size of a nut or a walnut. Now the Gemara continues with that which we saw in the Mishnah, niar kedei lichtov alav kesher moksin, the amount of papyrus or paper is the amount for a tax receipt, which again we said was two letters, tana, kama kesher moksin, what's the size of a tax receipt? Shtei otiot. It's two letters. Yereminu. Is that true? Hamotzi niyar chalak. Someone who takes out blank paper of papyrus. Im yesh bo kdei lichtov shtei otiot, chayav. If there's enough room to write two letters, then you're chayav. Vim lav. If not, then you are patur. So the Gemara's assumption over here is that there's a difference in the size of the lettering. And that is the lettering of a tax collector's receipt is bigger than your standard lettering. And so that's the nature of the question. The reminu is that blank paper is the amount that you need to write two regular letters on, whereas a kesher mochsin is something that you have two large letters on. So it seems to be that there's a stira between our Mishnah that requires two large letters in order to be chayav for niyar, whereas the breita that we just brought says that niyar only needs two regular sized letters in order to be chayav. So now we have two ways to answer that. Amar Rav Sheshet, my shtei otiot shel kesher mochsin. The two otiot in the breita doesn't mean two regular size otiot, it means two large size otiot, like the size you would use in a tax receipt. Rav Amar shtei otiot idan ubeit achiza. In the blank paper, you have two regular size letters, plus a location or a border around which you can hold it. Dehainu, which is equivalent to kesher mochsin, a tax receipt which has two large letters with no margin or border around it. Rashi claims that the tax receipt needs no border or place to hold it because you stick it in the palm of your hand and you display it in the palm of your hand, and therefore it doesn't need any margin or doesn't need any beit achiza. So Rashi says it's an after-the-fact item. It's because the way that you present it, it doesn't need to be held. The Baal Tosafot, on the other hand, suggests that the beit achiza has to do with the writing of it, that when it comes to the writing of two regular letters, you need to hold the item that you're writing the letters on. You have to be able to grasp it somehow, and that's the beit achiza. The kesher mochsin doesn't need a beit achiza, although Tosafot doesn't explain why that is the case. The Sfat Emet suggests that the reason is because the tax collector writes numerous of these receipts together, and therefore he can hold on to some other piece or some other part of the receipt, and then write four or five receipts where he then cuts them out, and there is no margin or border around them. So that's the difference, according to Rava, but they're the same size. One of them has a margin, one of them does not have a margin on it. Meitave, is that really true? Hamotzi neyar machuk, someone who takes out erased paper, shtar parua, or a page star, imesh beloven shelo, if it has in the margin around it that was not erased, or that was not used for the shtar, kedei lichtov shtei otiot, the ability to write two letters, o bekulo, or the entirety of the paper or the shtar is sufficient, or it has sufficient amount that you can use it as a plug or a cover for a file of perfume, chayav, then you are chayav, v'im lav, if not, then you are patur. So bishlam mother of sheishet amar my shteyotiot. What does it mean, two letters? Shteyotiot shel kesher mochsin. When it says two letters, it means two large size letters that are used in a tax receipt. Shapir, then that will be the explanation of the breita that we just brought here as well. And therefore, our Mishnah and all these breitot are all consistent in requiring the same shiur, which is two letters of the size that are found on a tax collector's receipt. That's what our Mishnah says. The other Mishnah says, shtei otiot, meant two otiot of a tax collector's size. And similarly over here, on the margin, when you're speaking about two letters, you're speaking about two letters that are the size of letters that would be used on a tax receipt. And in that way, they're all consistent with each other. On the other hand, Elul Rova, who says that the breita that we brought down was different than our Mishnah, the Amar Shtei Otiot Didan Ubeit Achiza, and the reason is because in the case of the Mochsin, it's two letters without any margin or place to hold it. Whereas the case of the Braita was two regular letter size, but you have a margin or a place to hold it, and therefore it equaled the Hainu Keshem Mokhsin, which is the same size as two letters on a tax receipt. Hacha Beit Achiza Lo Tzarich. Here you don't need a margin or something to hold it with because you have the erase paper or you have the Shtar Parua, where you can hold it. And then you're writing on the margin, so you don't need additional margin around it because you already have something else to hold it with. And if that's the case, then the two letters here would be smaller than that of the tax collector's receipt, and that would then be a stira with our Mishnah. And the Gemara says, Kasha, according to Rava's explanation, it would be problematic. Tan Rabbanan, Hamotzi Kesher Mokhsin, Ad Shelo Hero LeMokhes, before he shows it to the tax collector, Chayav. Then he is chayav for carrying it on Shabbat because it's useful to him. Mishiro the Mochis, once he's already used the tax receipt and been exempted from the taxes, if he carries it then it's patur because it's no longer useful to him. Vildomer, af Mishiro the Mochis. Even after he's used it or shown the tax receipt to the Mochis, to the tax collector, chayav, bibnei shetzarichlo, because he still needs it. It says, my benayu. What's the difference between them? Now obviously the Gemara is not asking, what's the difference between them? Because it's clear that their opinion's different with regards to whether after you've used the receipt, it still has significance. But the question is more fundamental, which is, why is it that they differ about this issue? So Amar Abaye, Ike Benayu, Rehite, Mukhsa. It has a difference for the tax enforcers. There were these people that ran around checking on people to make sure that they paid their taxes. If they did, they'd haul them in order to make sure that they paid their taxes. So Rabbi Yehuda believes that these rehite mukhsa are pests, and you need to get them off your back, even if you've already shown it to the tax collector himself. His henchmen or these enforcers need to be placated, and you're going to use the receipt to show them that you already paid. Whereas the chachamim believe, as Rashi says over here, that if he believes, he'll tell them that he paid it, or he was exempt from the taxes. And if they don't believe him, he'll go back with them to the tax collector, and the tax collector will say, you're right, yes, this guy already paid, I know that, I know him, he's exempt from taxes. So they don't worry about these enforcers because they'll go back to the tax collector at worst and they'll get the whole thing cleared up. So that's the machloka between them according to Abaye. Rava Amar Mokhes Gadol Mokhes Katan. Rava says the difference is between a major or primary tax collector. Mokhes Katan is the people that he appoints to collect the taxes on his behalf. Ike Benayu. So then again here you have the same problem, which is that the exemption was granted by the main tax collector, but the people that he appoints to collect the taxes on his behalf, they don't know that. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, you need the receipt to show it to these lower tax people or his hired help, because they don't know about the exemption. Whereas the Tana Kama says, once the tax exemption is produced or shown to the main tax collector, he provides some sort of sign or secret password that you give to the collectors so they know that you've actually shown it to him and he's approved of your exemption, and therefore you don't need your receipt any longer. Vashi Amar, Chad Mokhes Ika Benayu. The difference between them is if there's a single tax collector, Shitzarich Lo Larot the Mokhes Sheni, because you need to show it to the second tax collector, Tamalei Chazi Gavra the Mokhes Ana. You can see that I'm a trustworthy, upstanding taxpayer. Even though you're granted exemption from that tax collection, there are other tolls or taxes along the way which you will have to pay. And this individual doesn't want people to turn him into the authorities or cause him problems. So he carries around the receipt to show that normally he does pay taxes, but he happens to be exempt. Even though he'll have to pay taxes at the second location and the toll there, nevertheless showing them that he is an upstanding citizen is helpful for him when he pays the taxes to the second tax collector. And so even though it's a different tax collector and exemption's not relevant to him, nevertheless, that exemption gives him standing, and therefore he'll hold on to it. That's what Rabbi Yehuda believes. According to the Tana Kama, it's not something that is meaningful because he's going to have to pay the taxes to the second individual anyway. If he pays, he'll be upstanding. If he doesn't pay, then he's not upstanding. It doesn't matter that he's exempt from the previous tax collector that he had passed by or the previous toll that he had passed by. Right, Tana Rabbanan, a motzi shtar chov ad shelo paro. A person who takes out a document of debt collection before it was paid, chayav. If the creditor takes that out, he is chayav because it has significance to him because he can collect with it, and therefore he's chayav. Mishi paro, once it's already been repaid, patur. Then if he carries it out, it has no longer any significance to him, and he is patur.
Rabbi Yehuda Omer, af mishi paro chayav. Even after it was paid, it is still problematic. Meneisha tzarich lo, because he needs it. Again, ma beinayu, what's the difference between them? It's obvious what the difference is. What is the fundamental reason behind the distinction that they have with regards to a paid shtar chov? So, Amar Rav Yosef, asur the shahod shtar parua ike beinayu. The question is whether it is restricted or it's improper for you to keep around a shtar that's already been paid. There is a pasuk in Iyov that says, Al tishkon be'ohalecha avla. You shouldn't keep things that are deceitful or can cause perversion of the law or problems inside of your house. And a shtar parua is a risky thing to keep around because it could be that the person will pass away and then his children will see this shtar that was already paid, but it doesn't say anything about it, and they'll go and try to collect with it again. Or the individual himself will forget about it and collect with it himself. Or he will intentionally collect with it himself. So keeping a shtar parua around is improper. So the Rabbana on the Tana Kama believes, asur the shahod shtar parua. That's problematic. And since it's asur to keep it around, it's not useful to you in any way. The only thing you can do with it is destroy it. And since that's the primary purpose, carrying it around is not going to do it for you with it because you can't use it for anything. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda savar mutar l'shot shtar parua. He thinks that it's okay to keep around a shtar parua. We don't suspect people of coming back and reusing it, and therefore it's useful to the malveh, to the creditor, because he can use it not for collecting, obviously, the loan again, but he can use it as a cover for a perfume bottle, and therefore he's chayav for carrying it around. Now Rabbi Kiva Eger over here notes that according to the Rabbonon, it's a little strange why, even if it's a sword to keep around a shtar parua, why can't you simply just erase the shtar? And once you've erased the shtar, then it becomes like niyar machuk, which we saw at the top of the amud, is something that you can use as a cover for a file of perfume. And so why is it that even according to Rabbanu, so you can't keep around a paid shtar, as long as you erase the shtar, it's still useful to you after it's been erased. And so why aren't you chayav for carrying it out at that size at least? Maybe not the size of a shtar, but at least the size that you would cover. Rabbi Vega asked that over here. The Rashash answers because it hasn't been erased yet. Since it hasn't been erased yet, that is a deficit in this item that makes it insignificant to the individual now because he needs to destroy it in its current state. And that's why you're not chayav for carrying it according to the Rabbanan. Abaye amar, dekuleyama asur l'shahot shtar parua. Everybody agrees, both the Chachamim, the Tana Kama, and Rabbi Yehuda believe, you're not allowed to keep around a shtar that's already been paid. The question here is, b'modeh b'shtar shekatavo, shetzarich l'kaimo kamif l'gei. Tana Kama savar modeh b'shtar shekatavo tzarich l'kaimo. Rabbi Yehuda savar modeh b'shtar shekatavo ein tzarich l'kaimo. The Tana Kama believes that if the loveh agrees that he wrote the shtar, he still has to be validated or verified. Rabbi Yehuda believes that if he admits that he wrote it, that's sufficient reason to collect with it, and you don't need an additional verification. When the debtor agrees that he wrote the shtar, meaning that he is the one who indebted himself to this creditor and he owes the money, do you need to uphold the shtar? Now, typically, anywhere else in Shas, the word tzarich l'kaimo means with edim. You need third-party witnesses to come and to affirm that this is a proper shtar, which would mean that if even if the debtor agrees that he wrote the shtar and he indebted himself to this creditor, the malveh still has an obligation to bring witnesses to verify the signatures on the shtar in order to make it into a full-fledged shtar that he can collect with. So if you need that, then the shtar is worthless to you because you haven't been mekayem it. You haven't verified it with the edim, and therefore the shtar is useless. On the other hand, if you believe that you do not have to be mekayem it, you do not have to verify the signatures on the shtar, as long as the debtor agrees that he wrote the shtar, then the obligation is on the debtor to bring proof that he hasn't repaid it, because otherwise the malveh, the creditor, can say, shtarcha b'yodi maboy. Why do I have the shtar in my hand if you don't owe me the money? And his admission is sufficient grounds to uphold the shtar and make it into a regular shtar. And we don't worry about a knunia, we don't worry about them colluding to steal from other creditors of this debtor by saying that it was an unpaid shtar, even though it was a paid shtar, and therefore we don't require that the malveh will verify it. Over here, Rashi does not explain it that way. That would be the typical way to explain it in terms of the kaimo. Now, Tosfot points out, why does it matter that he can't be mekayim it now, that he can't find people to verify the shtar now? maybe in the future he'll find someone to verify the signatures on the shtar and it'd still be useful to him. So Tosafot says it has to be a case here. Mari ish yodea shel yuchal klal imtso edei kiyum. It's a case or a situation where he knows he's not going to find any edim to support or verify the signatures on the shtar. And even though, as Tosafot points out, he could keep it anyway and say that I want to use it to cover up one of my bottles, and we can't take it away from it because he claims it wasn't paid, the shtar. The Malva says that it's still an outstanding shtar, even though the Lova claims that it was already paid back. Nevertheless, the Malva, the creditor, says it wasn't paid. Why we have a right to take it away from him, and why isn't it significant, even according to the Chachamim, who say that he can't be Mekayim it? Tosafot then suggests that once the individual says that he ainly edim, I have no witnesses, vainly raya, I have no proof, v'loyam tzakiyum, and I will not in the future find anybody to verify these, afilu matzach arkein, even if afterwards he finds edim to verify the shtar, eno mo'il, it doesn't help, because he already declared himself lacking any evidence over here, and therefore if he brings something in the future, we worry that he paid someone to do that, or it's a lie, and therefore we don't let him keep it, because maybe in the end he will verify it and collect with it, even though he's not allowed to collect with it. And therefore we're going to confiscate the shtar from him, and that's why it's problematic for him to keep the shtar. As we noted before, everywhere else in Shas, Rashi explains that the kaimo means what they deem. Over here, Rashi says the kaimo is by the loveh. Ha-loveh modeh shekatavo, tzarech the kaimo. Even when the loveh himself admits that he wrote the shtar, he has to be mekayim the shtar v'lomar lo parati, and say that the kiyum comes from the fact that he says, I didn't pay it back. In that case, then the kaimo is not about the edim being mekayim it, rather the loveh needs to be mekayim it. Meaning that if the loveh says lo parati, then the shtar is an effective shtar, and then he can collect with it. On the other hand, if the loveh does not say lo parati, the shtar is not valid shtar. It is not a valid shtar, even though the loveh admitted that he wrote the shtar, because he still has the right to then claim parati. And a pesh asur, he's the one who says, I wrote it, is pesh itir. He can make the claim that I paid it back. So the question is, do you need this kiyum? According to the Chachamim, not only do you need the loveh to admit that he wrote it, you need him to admit that he didn't pay it back. And as long as he doesn't say, I haven't paid it back, the shtar is worthless because he hasn't been mekayim it, and you're going to need edim to fill it in. Since you don't have those edim, the shtar is worthless, and then you move over to the Baalei Tosafot to say, why is it that without edim it's worthless? Either because he says, I'm never going to find edim, because he says, I'm never going to find edim. Not only can I not find them now, I will not find them in the future. Never we confiscate the shtar. Then Rabbi Yehuda believes that as soon as the loveh says that I wrote the shtar, we don't need him to affirm the shtar and say lo parati. Simply, if he doesn't say anything, then he can collect with the shtar, the malveh, because until the loveh makes a claim of parati, he makes a negative claim, which is that I did pay it back already, then it would undermine the shtar. But as long as he doesn't say that, the shtar is a valid shtar, and therefore you don't need the kiyum of the loveh. But if you don't need the kiyum of the loveh, you also don't need the kiyum of edim, because it's automatically a good shtar by the loveh admitting to it. That's the way that Rashi explains it over here, slightly differently about the word kiyum than he uses in other places in Shas, but the idea is the same, which is the shtar, once you have an admission of the loveh that he wrote it, a valid shtar, which is Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, and therefore, if you Malbec carries it out, the creditor carries it out, it would be problematic. Or do we say that even after the loveh admits that he wrote the shtar, you still need some sort of kiyum, whether it's a kiyum by the loveh, who says lo parati, or kiyum by third-party edim, who come along and testify that they know or recognize the signatures on this shtar, and that's mikayim, verifies or validates the shtar, in order for the malveh to collect from it, and since that's lacking in this case, the chachamim believe that the shtar is not a collectible shtar, and that's why when he carries it out, the malveh it's not chayab, because it's not useful to him. If that's the case, what is ad shelo paro o mishipiro? What does it mean that when he paid or he didn't pay it? Here the discussion is not whether he paid it or not. The question is whether the shtar needs to be verified or validated or not. So that's what the Gemara says. Achiyomar loveh parati velo parati. And this is probably what influenced Rashi to explain it slightly differently over here, which is it's not that it was paid or it wasn't paid. It's a case where he says, I paid it or I didn't pay it. And that's, according to Rashi, the kiyum over here. Because if he says lo parati, that's a validation of the shtar. If he says parati, that's an undermining of the shtar. And the Chachamim believe you need active validation. So until he says lo parati, according to Rashi, then you can't collect with it. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda believes you don't need the validation, and therefore it would be valid to collect with that shtar. Rav Amar, so Rav says, no, everybody agrees that you have to validate the shtar. The machloket is whether you write a receipt or you don't write a receipt. Tanakama savar kodvim shover. The Tanakama says that you write a receipt, Rabbi Yehuda savar, en kodvim shover. And the Rabbi Yehuda says that you don't write a receipt. Rashi says that there was an opposite girsa, which Rashi dismisses because we know from other places in Shas, Rabbi Yehuda is the one who says that ain't kodvin shover, that you don't write a receipt, because we don't want the loveh to have to keep this receipt forever, otherwise be under the threat that the creditor is going to pull out the shtar on him. And then he has now an obligation to keep it around. If it gets eaten by rodents or ruined, then he's going to be subject to being double collection. And Rabbi Yehuda says we don't want to put that burden on the loveh. And therefore, you can't write a receipt, you have to hand back the shtar. And so Rashi says that is consistent with Rabbi Yehuda's opinion everywhere else in Shas, and the girsa that we have is the proper girsa. So the Tanakama says you can write a shover, you write a receipt. And as Tosafot explains over here, it's a case where the creditor already gave the receipt to the debtor, so the debtor does not need the contract anymore because he has the receipt in his hand and he's happy. So then the malveh, the creditor, has no use for the shtar because he doesn't have to hand it back to the loveh. On the other hand, he's under the restriction of keeping around a shtar parua. So then the only thing he can do with this shtar is destroy it. It's not useful to him in any other way except that he has to destroy it. And that's why if he carries it out, it's not significant because there's no value to the shtar to the malveh. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda believes you don't write a receipt or there's no way to dismiss the shtar until the malveh hands it to the loveh to be ripped up. In this case, the creditor needs to hand the shtar over to the loveh in order for the loveh to be able to rip it up and not to have to hold on to the receipt. And if he doesn't return the shtar to the loveh can then go make a claim to get his money back. And therefore, the malveh is incented to keep the shtar because he needs to give the shtar to the loveh in order to keep the money that the loveh paid him for this indebtedness. And therefore, it has significance to the creditor. And for that reason, if he carries it out, he's going to be chayav, according to Rabbi Yehuda. Ravashi amar mipnei, that the loveh actually needs it. The debtor needs it. Shetzarich la'arato the bal chov sheni. Because he wants to show it to his other creditors. Damar lei chazigavra de parana. To show that he's an upstanding debt payer. And that when he borrows money, he repays it. So here, according to Ravashi, it's not speaking about the creditor taking it out. It's speaking about the debtor that's taking it out. According to the Tanakama, you're not allowed to keep a shtar like this around. Even the loveh doesn't want to keep a shtar like this around. And he wouldn't keep it around simply to put it on top or cover something because there's too much risk that if he loses it, that he would be then collected from again. So his biggest incentive is to get rid of it and not to keep it around. Whenever he carries it out, it's worthless because he really wants to get rid of it. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda believes that even though, yes, he would like to get rid of it, it serves him a purpose. And that purpose is that he can show it to other creditors. Or when he's going to borrow money, he can show it to others that he borrowed money before and he repaid it. And since it gives him more believability with other creditors or standing with other creditors, he'll keep it around despite the risk of keeping it around that he can be collected from twice. And since it has significance to him, if the debtor carries it out, he's going to be chayav for that. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Ayin Tet Amud Aleph.